Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I am John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, September 8, 2016. The U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan says Riek Machar should stay away from Juba.
He and Salva Kiir are unable to work together, and if they have to have their security forces there because they don't trust each other, those security forces have proven that they cannot coexist in the same town, and so you had the fighting of Juba. We don't want to see a return to that.
And aid agencies say humanitarian conditions are worsening in several parts of South Sudan.
The biggest challenge is the current dire humanitarian situation that the people in the area are experiencing. And by the way, these people, as I said before, these people are hardworking, but the situation actually forced them to be in that situation.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan, Ambassador Donald Boot, told congressional lawmakers yesterday that Riek Machar, South Sudan's former first vice president who fled the country in July, should not return to reclaim his previous position. Boot says Machar's working relations with President Kiir is not good, but Machar's representatives in Washington argues that the statement is not consistent with the terms of the peace agreement. South Sudan in Focus reporter Ayen Bior was at the hearing and has this report.
Speaking at the House of Representatives Foreign Affairs Subcommittee hearing, Ambassador Boots said the lack of trust between Machar and South Sudan's President Salva Kiir has created one of the most extreme humanitarian situations in the world.
It's clear that he and Salva Kiir are unable to work together, and if they have to have their security forces there because they don't trust each other, those security forces have proven that they cannot coexist in the same town, and so you had the fighting of Juba. We don't want to see a return to that.
Speaking to VOA after the hearing, Ambassador Princeton Lyman, the former U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan, said observers should consider a comprehensive approach when considering the role of Machar.
Because you have to remember that Ambassador Booth talked also about a more inclusive government. And the question is, how do you get to a more inclusive government without more of the supporters of Riek Machar, whether he personally or otherwise is involved in the government?
Lyman added that it is not clear if the U.S. will advocate for Machar's return once the deployment of the Rapid Protection Force enters South Sudan. Riyad Mojtang, the SPLA in opposition representative for North America, said he was disappointed by Boot's remarks, stating that the ambassador's comments support the abrogation of the peace agreement.
It seems very complicated now because the government is talking that there is a peace in Juba, and there is no peace in Juba. And actually, to us, there is no transitional government of national unity, because if the peace collapse, if the two partners actually are not working together, there is no government in place.
Much also said that President Kiir's appointment of Taban Dengai, who replaced Machar in late July, is inconsistent with the peace deal signed over a year ago. The Associated Press reported last month that South Sudanese troops raped foreign women, beat and robbed people, and killed local journalists in July in Juba's Terrain compound, a venue frequented by foreigners. Representative Chris Smith, a Republican from New Jersey and chairman of the House Subcommittee on Africa, says one of his constituents was among the foreigners attacked during that incident, which lasted several hours. The victim from New Jersey was expected to testify at Wednesday's hearing, but decided not to because she was still traumatized, according to Smith. Representative Thomas Rooney, a Republican from Florida, said he does not believe that South Sudan's leaders can reverse the course of violence in the country and urged Ambassador Booth to immediately implement an arms embargo.
And what can it hurt if the United States does take the lead to say that enough is enough? We've got diplomatic envoys being shot at. We've got all kinds of crimes that we've talked about against its own citizenry. We've got humanitarian aid and food being seized upon. We've got the opposition has fled. We've got a government that's lost control of its own military.
Asked if observers should expect a change in U.S. policy towards South Sudan in light of recent developments, Smith said the shift is already in the process of happening, adding that there are only a few days left for South Sudan to pivot on the side of protection and advocacy for human rights. Calling Machar the legitimate leader, Mudge said the former first vice president, who was still recovering from injuries sustained while fleeing the capital, Juba, shortly after fighting broke out in July, is still in control of the opposition forces. Festus Mahai, chairman of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, the body overseeing the peace agreement, told the Associated Press recently that the legitimacy of Tabandangai is questionable, but diplomats will continue to work with him because they don't have an option. Brian Adeba, the Associate Director of Policy at the Washington-based Enough Project, says more consideration should be placed on the ability of Deng to lead the opposition movement.
I would reiterate that it's very important to look at Tabandangai himself. Does he have the support of the rank and file of the IO? That is really the determining factor here. If he has, I think then it's good to go. If he doesn't, then that's a problem.
Mudge says the majority of the opposition does not support Deng and sees his appointment as a violation of the peace agreement.
Because, you know, that there should be replacement. The process are not legitimate because there was no SPLM opposition that said to replace Machar. It was only four people. And SPLM, we have 270 members of the National Liberation Council and 28 members of the Political Bureau. And no one sat there to change the leadership, to replace the leadership.
Mudge says Machar is still committed to the peace agreement, and there will be no problem if President Kiir respects the agreement. For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
Authorities and aid agencies say humanitarian conditions continue to worsen in the former Central Equatorial state as fighting continues to flare in parts of the area. Many citizens have fled to Uganda as a result of the fighting. The International Organization for Migration says more than 1.6 million South Sudanese are displaced nationwide because of the violence. Michael Atit has this story for VOA from Juba.
Government officials and aid agencies say fighting has continued in parts of the former Central Equatorial state between government and a non-armed group, forcing thousands of civilians fleeing the area over the past 2 months. One of the state's hardest hit in the recent days is Yei River State. Paul Yuane Bonju, a member of parliament representing Yei in the National Assembly, says insecurity is rampant.
I have some of my relatives, even they did not attempt to move out of Yei, but some actually moved. Some went deep into the bush, and then some left to Uganda, and some are still on the way. So it is a situation that one cannot be able actually to pinpoint exactly what is taking place. And as I say, let me repeat myself, because of the communication distances with the area, things are a little bit not all that clear. So like yesterday, I tried to connect with Jay. I could not succeed. This morning, I also tried to connect with Jay. I could not succeed. And I'm connecting.
Bonju says the continued insecurity in Yei hampers economic activities and prevents aid agencies from reaching people in desperate need of assistance.
The biggest challenge is the current dire humanitarian situation that the people in the area are experiencing. And by the way, these people, as I said before, these people are hardworking, but the situation actually forced them to be in that situation. Communication between Yei and Juba has not been there for some time.
The town of Yei is 100 miles south of Juba and has been cut off from the capital by the fighting in the area. Yei has been one of the main breadbasket of Juba. Communication officer with the UN Refugee Agency, Roko Nuri, says his organization has been cut off from the area of over a month now. His organization has been cut off from the area for over a month now. He says residents of Yei have fled to Uganda.
The vast majority of South Sudanese from that area, but, you know, from the greater equatorial region, have been moving into Uganda over the past month and a half. Indeed, our operation in Uganda received so far more than 100,000 refugees in the span of 1 month and a half.
Nuri says because of the blockage, they are unable to deliver food aid, medicine, and other basic needs to the refugee in Lasso. He did not state who exactly blocks their operations, but says the ongoing fighting between government forces and various militias has created all sorts of challenges. The International Organization for Migration, or IOM, says the number of IDPs who need assistance in Wau is rising, as thousands who fled to the bush during the violence are coming home and joining thousands of other IDPs sheltering in church and school compounds. IOM's evaluation officer, Ian McClellan, says some families in Wau are looking for safe haven.
We continue serving IDP populations, most recently in Western Barlow-Gazelle in the Wau area. IDPs are moving to protection sites within Wau and displacement sites for their own protection as a means to protect themselves and their families.
McClellan says, despite enormous challenges, aid workers remain committed to offering service to the needy.
We do make specific requests for access to government and key stakeholders or key partners so that we can try and gain access as quickly as possible. We all work to gain access and to deliver services needed to the most vulnerable population. You know, we are always confident that we will be able to break through those challenges to continue delivering aid to the most needed.
Violence erupted in Wau town in June between an unidentified armed group and government soldiers. Nearly 50 people were killed and thousands of others were displaced. 38-year-old Assunta Giuliano Tadi fled to the Catholic Church compound in Wau with her 15-day-old baby. Tadi says she nearly lost her child due to poor conditions at the church compound. Speaking in Arabic, Tadi says she is afraid to return home because of the insecurity outside the church compound. Tadi says, I can't abandon my house. I was forced with my kids and come and stay in the camp. And still, it is not secure for us to go back. She says, 2 days ago, she attempted to visit her house during the day, but on her way, she met with soldiers. She says, they always threaten people and loot their money and phones. Tadi says she could not reach home. She just decided to go back. Father Moses Peter Joseph is a Catholic priest in Wau. Moses says the IDPs do not have enough to eat. He is calling on humanitarian agencies to provide food to the IDPs.
The IDPs we have, they are always given food of 15 days ratio. And again, they'll come after 1 month and give 15 days ratios for each individual. So that is what I've seen. There is a gap or there is still more needed.
McClellan admits that the IDPs are facing food shortages. He says IOM is working to secure more funds from donors to provide more relief food to the needy people across South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
Waki Simon Wudu contributed to this report from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese will have no access to health care in Imatong and Namurunyang states following a decision by the Catholic Diocese of Torit to temporarily shut down 3 health facilities. Church officials say they have run out of money to buy medicine and pay staff at these facilities. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Torit.
Catholic Diocese of Torit closed the Kapoeta Mission Hospital, Naru's Primary Health Center in Namurunyang State, and Pageri Primary Health Care Center in Imatong State. 6 days ago, the German-based charity Misero withdrew from funding the facilities and asked state governments to take responsibility for their citizens' health care. Kapoeta residents say the closure of Kapoeta Mission Hospital means they have no access to health care services. Kapoeta South County resident Juspin Namana says she fears many HIV and tuberculosis patients might die as a result and is calling on state authorities to address the situation.
The patients of HIV and AIDS are getting drugs there.
The patients of HIV are getting drugs from there where they can access drugs at any time, and also TB patients also are getting their drugs there. And now, since the hospital is closed, they have nowhere to get drugs, since this was the only hospital delivering such services. So this is a big problem.
Resident Roslyn Nakoki says some patients are dying because the hospital was shut down.
The hospital was having well-trained nurses and were helping a lot of people who could go there and get quick health services, and they were available every time and then. It's really affecting. People are dying. Many patients started dying.
William Okot is managing director of Caritas Torit, a church organization that manages the health care facilities. Okot says their German-based donor wants the Imotong and Namurunyang state governments to provide health care services to the population of the two states.
They came up with the recommendation that some of these facilities have to be scaled down, closed, or Catholic Diocese of Torit should find some ways of funding them. And the criteria was that some of these facilities are near the facilities of the government, like hospitals of the government are near. So they prefer at least services to the people who are in need of health services could go to these facilities. It is like, duplicating giving services. So they prefer to actually give funding for those areas that do not have facilities at all.
Okot says Miserio officials had informed state and church officials about their plans to stop funding the three health facilities.
It's unfortunate that the social wing of the Catholic Diocese of Torit, for that matter, Caritas Torit, doesn't have any intention, okay, to harm or to hurt our people. It's only that it has no source of funds. We depend on donors. Now, if a donor says, sorry, we cannot continue with you, what do we do? So it affects us as the service providers, and it affects the people who are receiving the services. So it's very unfortunate, and we will struggle because this is our obligation as Caritas Torit, as the church, the Catholic Church of Torit, to make sure that we try to find other ways to continue helping, serving our people.
The Mission Hospital in Caputa had been treating hundreds of tuberculosis and HIV patients. The only government hospital in the area, Caputa State Hospital, has been receiving more than 200 patients a day. Local health officials say the hospital cannot handle that many patients. Stella Loreka is the Namurunyang State Health Minister.
And the population now is too high. There are so many people it has really affected. And especially in the field of HIV and TB. At least some of the people were in the DOT. But now it's a big thing, you know. We have only two wards in a Caputa State Hospital. It's now a state hospital. Accommodation even is a big problem in the hospital. There is no space. Now it's congested. This is a big challenge for us. Though HPF Health Pool Fund is promising that they will support the Caputa Mission Hospital, but it is up to next month. Is when HPF will come in. But at the moment, it's closed. Yeah, it's true.
Loreka says state officials sent volunteers to provide basic health services at Caputa Mission Hospital and the Naru's Primary Health Care Center for the past 3 days. But the volunteers have not left because they refused to continue working without pay. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Torit.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, what can be done to stop young Sudanese from turning to religious extremists? Find out when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what are you most grateful for?
Grateful for my life, because I'm alive, I have a job, and I'm happy.
I'm grateful because I'm at campus. I'm at the university. Yeah, that's my favorite thing I've ever thought of and I've ever dreamt about, being at campus.
My parents, I'm grateful for them. They've been around for me for all this long. Actually, they've been struggling to pay my school fees up to this level. It's not easy to get money, but they are paying my fees, and I'm so grateful for them.
I'm most grateful for my brothers, because they are taking care of me since I lost my father in 2010. But I'm still alive because of my brothers. They are taking care for me.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. The Sudan National Commission for Countering and Preventing Extremism wrapped up a two-day workshop this week aimed at developing strategies to combat violence, extremism in Sudan and the Horn of Africa. A consensus was reached at the workshop on the need to engage young people who are vulnerable to religious ideas. Nabil Biagio reports for VOA from Khartoum.
The workshop at the Khartoum Hotel brought together United Nations officials, academics, local and international NGOs, as well as representatives from the Horn and Eastern Africa. Mohammed Jamal is the Director General at Sudan's National Commission for Countering Terrorism.
The reason why we are consulting people, we would like this strategy is to come from the root, to come from the people, to come from the component of the community itself. Whether it is the private sector, or it is, the government, or whatever the community or the body is.
Jamal says Sudan is one of the countries in the region directly affected by terrorism and violent extremism. He says one case in point is the dozens of university medical students in Khartoum who left their studies last year to join the Islamic State in Syria.
We are touched by this violent extremism in a way or another, because we have got some or many youth who just left their universities, and they're very brilliant and very outstanding students. They went, and because of lack of knowledge and lack of lack of even the peaceful environment. Sometimes I don't know when there are problems and disputes in the country, that will breed, a lot of problems.
Jamal says intellectuals and civil society members must open channels of dialogue with young people who might be attracted to extremism.
What we would like to do at the end of the day, we'll try to develop this strategy, and with the collaboration of, the United Nations and the regional organizations and the international also organizations, so that we can have one concrete document and with good, factors of recommendations, so that it could be flexible and be realistic, because actually we need, at the end of the day, programs that we can put on the ground, in the field there, to be implemented.
Youth activist Tariq Abdullah says poverty and lack of opportunities are to blame for many young Sudanese being attracted to extremism. He says the ideology of the Khartoum regime and its harsh policies also make for fertile grounds for violent extremism.
Unemployment is one reason, and the general economic situation. Another thing is the ideology of the Islamic ruling National Congress Party that leads to extremism and gives freedom to fundamentalist groups to operate Sudan.
Abdullah says if the Sudan government is serious about combating terrorism, they should stop enabling it. Salva Ramachandran is the United Nations Development Programme Country Director in Sudan. He says the UN stands ready to support the Sudanese organizations in their efforts to combat terrorism.
The issue is very complex, and proper understanding has to be developed, and that can only come from series of consultation. In Sudan, we are very, very committed, and we will continue to work with different ministries as well as think tanks, NGOs, civil society.
Jamal says more consultative workshops will be held in the coming months to formulate a clear action plan to stop the threat of violent extremism in Sudan and the region. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio.
Kenya is hosting the Africa Green Revolution Forum this week. While the organizers say the continent is well on its way to an agricultural renaissance, significant challenges remain. Lenin Ruvaga has the story for VOA from Nairobi.
The forum is wrapping up with what organizers are calling a blockbuster moment, a pledge of $30 billion during the next 10 years to support smallholder farmers and local African agribusinesses. The donors include African governments, businesses, and development partners, many of whom are present here in Nairobi. Experts have many theories on what it will take to make Africa's green revolution a reality. Country manager James Krask of Yara, a leading fertilizer manufacturing company in Africa, says better quality seeds and fertilizer would make a difference.
I think really we need to look at the farm management for smallholders, the quality of the inputs for smallholders, but especially the knowledge level of the smallholders in how to use those inputs to get the most optimal yield and quality, so that they can move from smallholders can move from subsistence farming to commercial farming and really become more and more profitable.
Many African countries are seeking to become food self-sufficient. It is a goal that has gained even more urgency in the past year. Low global commodity prices have tugged down African economies and currencies, raising the prices of imports at markets. El Nino-induced drought left 30 million people food insecure in southern Africa. 50 years ago, Africa was exporting agricultural products to the world. A new report released by Agra Alliance, which is hosting the forum, states that the continent spends $35 billion importing food each year and loses $4 billion to food waste. Rockefeller Foundation Managing Director for Africa, Mamadou Bitaye, sees a comprehensive approach to growth.
The continent produces sufficiently to feed itself. The problem we have is that about 30 to 40% of everything we produce is lost due to inefficiencies. That's where the challenge of feeding ourselves comes in. So it is really important that we look agriculture in total, pre and post-harvest management, value addition, transforming our agricultural produce to meet the changing consumption needs of our populations.
Addressing the forum, Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta said agriculture is also about more than just food.
We are aware growth in agriculture is up to 11 times more effective at reducing poverty than growth in any other sector. And we also recognize that until this sector is transformed, our hopes of industrialization as a continent and for us to have a flourishing manufacturing sector will be a little more than a pipe dream without transforming our agriculture.
The Agra Alliance says African governments would need to invest at least an additional $13 billion annually to truly revolutionize agriculture on the continent. The goal would be to move from the small-scale subsistence-style farming that at the moment employs the majority of Africa's workforce to mechanical and profit-based agriculture. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
That story by Lenny Ruvaga from Nairobi brings us to the end of our show for this Thursday. We now take you to Yei with a song by Benjamin Laksin. The title is Amba.
Amba ye, amba ye ye, amba ye ye, patilipa.
Amba ye ye, amba ye ye, amba ye ye, patilipa.
Nirona sodomogo, nirona sodomogo, nirona sodomogo, belibibilo gandara.
Amba ye ye, amba ye ye, amba ye ye, patilipa.
Nirona kekeli, nirona kekeli, nirona kekeli, betikasreketi.
Amba ye ye, amba ye ye. Amba ye ye patilipa.
Nirona rudongo, nirona rudongo, nirona rudongo kubona amba.
Amba ye ye, amba ye ye, amba ye ye patilipa.
Ngalaga kuden amba bero, ku amba langodi kiko, ngaji kine bindo lenga beri. Nirola suda beti manyan, kote bakana, patilipa lolele kike dingiki. Ikururunga nyo amba doti kinda ngaji kinda lenga
be. Amba ye amba ye ye amba ye ye patilipa. Amba ye ye amba ye ye amba ye ye patilipa.
Ngira na sodomogo ngira na sodomogo ngira na sodomogo beli.
Well, we have been listening to Benjamin Laksin rapping in his Kakwa native language. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for allowing us into your homes and vehicles. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.